The Living Earth is a Portland group that meets the first Friday of each month for a vegetarian potluck at the Multnomah Friends Monthly Meeting House. Each month, there's a speaker and topic after the meal. October's speaker is Thomas Gomez, detailing the belief system currently held and acted upon by some 40 million Americans, the belief system called Rapturism. From the Portland Indie Media Calendar, discussion will focus on the radical fundamentalist concept of the rapture, the violent and dangerous theological prophecy, would be easy to shrug off as a delusional fantasy, except that it is believed by millions of Americans, including many elected officials and presidential advisors. It is worth understanding and recognizing when it is alluded to, in order to make some sense out of the political show now on stage in Washington, D.C. Thomas Chavez will outline the background and substance of this belief system and facilitate a larger discussion after the talk. I'm Glenn Owen, KBOO Weekend Public Affairs on the web. We now join Betsy Toll as she welcomes us to the meeting and introduces the speaker.
Wow. Thank you. That's amazing. Welcome, everyone. What a wonderful thing to be back here. My name is Betsy Toll, and by back here, a lot of us in the room have been coming to First Friday for months or years. And we spent the summer doing First Fridays at Laurelhurst Park, so it's really nice to be back here. And welcome to people who haven't been here before. And I'll give a little rundown on what we're doing. Living Earth is, we're actually in our fourth year, I think, of doing First Fridays. And once a month we come together for a potluck and to gather information, share ideas, talk to each other, build community around issues that range from democracy to sustainable housing, CSA farms, violence in our culture, you know, a wide range of issues. Because Living Earth is not an issue organization, Living Earth is a cultural change organization, and if we don't recognize the connections of all the different manifestations of dysfunction in the culture, then we're slapping band-aids on something that really is much more systemic and problems that are much deeper and broader than any particular little symptom or issue might indicate. Some of us came just because we really like to see each other once a month, and it's great to get together and share food and share ideas and friendship. Others may have come because they were aware of this particular topic that Thomas Chavez is going to enlighten us about, the concept of the rapture. And after Thomas kind of lays out some information for us, shares his knowledge and familiarity with the subject matter and with the implications, we want to have discussion about that, because there are ways in which this is sort of percolating ideas of end times and ideas of, you know, cataclysmic crisis are percolating all over the political spectrum. And it's worth giving some thought to and thinking out loud together what that's all about, where that energy comes from. So Thomas Chavez is our presenter tonight.
But thank you. And thank you especially, Betsy, for the opportunity to talk in a place where I get to talk the way I prefer, which is to give context and to try to weave together ideas rather than try to cut things down into sound bites and say, this is what you got to remember. And that's it. I told you. Carry it. I'm trying. It's my joy to try and structure things so that people go home and think it through again for themselves. As Betsy said, my name is Thomas. I am with Christ the Healer, United Church of Christ. And Christ the Healer is actually in many ways a parallel kind of organization to Living Earth, except that we're a church. But we have outside the core of our having a spiritual focus, how we live that out is in the same spectrum of interests and concerns as you have here at Living Earth. So before I actually get into what I'm going to say, I'd like to have this interesting piece of propaganda played for you. This is from The Left Behind, the first effort
at
making a movie. There will be more efforts at making Left Behind movies. But this is what rapturist people are putting out for each other.
Honey, have you seen the kids?
Oh, super.
Where are they? Where are my kids?
This is Len Owen. I'm back in the studio. I will spare you most of this 4 minutes. I believe the little introit you heard and what you're going to hear just after I speak is quite enough. You won't miss the 4 minutes at all.
Written in the Left Behind series. At last count that I have, which is more than 6 months ago, more than 6 months ago, they had sold more than 60 million copies. And under normal publishing standards, you generally count 2.5 readers per book sold. And when it is a propaganda book, where people are actively trying to turn each other on, you count more. There is a lot of this worldview being pushed out into the world. So why should we care?
What is the worldview? What did that represent?
That represented rapturist thinking. That a doctrine that says that at the end time, when the entire human experiment is done and Christ returns, Christ is going to return twice. And the first time, he's going to take all the good people away and leave everybody else to have a bad time for 7 years. And at the end of the 7 years, he will come and punish everybody who didn't get it.
So
it's not a grace period, actually. And I'll explain all about that. And
how do these people figure that out in this movie? Is this a movie or a TV show?
This is a movie. And how do they figure it out?
Yeah.
There's 60 million copies of Left Behind.
Rapture has been in existence. Let's start. Let me go with where I really wanted to start, okay? Why is this important? Is it just a stupid idea that some people have and they go around saying, putting bumper stickers in the car in case of rapture, this car will be empty, in case, so that other people can have bumper stickers that says, in case of rapture, can I have your car? At that level, it's just a joke. And I want to establish why it's not a joke. The first time rapturist thinking became national political headline was during the Reagan administration. And that was when we had James Watt. I kept trying to say Jim. In my mind, I knew that one. James Watt. was Secretary of the Interior, and he didn't care about any kind of conservation. He wanted to cut down all the forests. He wanted to mine every land, hollow out all the mountains. We need big pits wherever, because the end of the world was coming. He and everybody else who deserved to be considered would be taken away, and if there was a mess, it wasn't their problem. The end is coming, and forget it. That affected national conservation policy, and that's when it became a political issue for other Americans in people's minds. But it had been a political issue for the U.S. for an awfully long time. One of the most important parts of why the rapture exists is because of Israel. The rapture doctrine, which goes back to 1830, many, many people think that this is Christian doctrine. It's not Christian doctrine. It's a weird thing that got grafted on starting in 1830. In 1830, there was no Israel. This guy, Darby, who had been an Anglican priest in Ireland and who had quit the Anglican Church, became part of a sect called the Plymouth Brethren, got sent up north to Glasgow, where there was a young woman, a young girl, 16 years old, named Margaret MacDonald. And she was doing what we, in our current culture, would call channeling. They called it prophesying. And she would speak in tongues, and then she would say things in English, and she was in a trance, and she was apparently very, very, very exciting to see this girl say strange things. And so he was set up by his sect to investigate, and he came back. She had, one of the things that she had said was that Christ would come back twice. He came back, Darby came back and wrote a report, a scathing report, saying that she was full of shit. And this was a terrible thing, and she, you know, forget about this phenomenon. And yet, the next time he sat down with his Bible, he opened it up. What he says in his notes is it jumped off the page that Bible prophecy actually has two tracks. One track for God's earthly people, the Jews, and one track for God's heavenly people, the church. And in order to make these two tracks work out, Jesus has to come back twice. And in Darby's creation, he has set it up so that it's now doctrine for rapturists. They call themselves dispensationalists, by the way. That comes back twice. He takes his church, the not all Christians, just the good ones, and sweeps them off the world of the earth. And now it's the time for the Jews, and incidentally anybody else who gets the message. But the reason why this is really, really important is that in Darby's interpretation, there has to be an Israel, and Israel has to rebuild the temple, which is still not theirs. The temple isn't rebuilt. For the purpose that halfway through the 7 years, the Antichrist, a phrase that he lifted from the book of Revelation, which the way he structures it is equivalent to the most incredible mad secular dictator and the devil mixed into one, so that the Antichrist can defile the temple. Until there was a rebirth of Israel, rapturous fantasies were just that, even for rapturists who believed that biblical prophecy was what they call futurist. Until at the time that all of this was first concocted in 1830, virtually everybody agreed that biblical prophecy was speaking about stuff that was in process and had been in process, and if there's any little pieces left that hadn't been fulfilled, it's just the very last piece. The Pilgrim Brethren that Darby had joined were a very small, extremely minority sect of futurists who really wanted to say, it's all, everything that you see in the Bible is going to happen way out there. So suddenly, people, dispensationalists, rapturists, found themselves at the beginning of watching their own process that they had the secret code. They were watching it happen. Israel came into existence. Then, the Six-Day War, Israel captured territories that had been central to ancient Israel. From that point on, American dispensationalists sent money to Israel, but not to Israel itself. They sent money into Israel to fund those elements among Israeli Jews who were the most likely to kick out the Muslims and rebuild the temple. The most nationalistic, the most uncompromising, the most lacking in compassion, the most militaristic. Many, many, many people wonder what happened to Israel. If you really understand what the theological and resulting psycho-emotional output of being a Jew is, it's about embracing the stranger. What happened to Israel? Why did the people who had suffered from fascism slowly evolve a parallel to fascism of their own? What was that about? How did that happen? It happened because Americans, for the most part, who want to see the end of the world, found elements in that society to pump up with enormous money so that those elements could have far more impact on their nation than their numbers would have normally given them any impact.
Can I ask you how you know these things and how it's tracked?
The guy who tracked that the best is this guy. Okay? The Road to Armageddon, Timothy P. Weber. And He's a university professor. The number of citations in here is so huge that it's virtually half the book. In this book, you're taken into who said what to whom, when, date by date, meeting by meeting, controversy by controversy. It is something that is studied now that it is controversial. That's really, what's happening. If you believe this rapturous theology, this belief, you get to look at all of the chaos, the confusion, the threat in the world, and you say, it's not my problem. That's one of the things that makes it very attractive to certain kind of people. All I have to do is be super good the way my pastor tells me is good. And either I die before it's over, or when it's going to get really bad, I get swept away. And the tendency historically has been for those who taught rapture to kind of want it all to be swept away. There's an underlying violence and resentment of the world as it is. But you could sublimate your violent rejection of the world. I'm not attacking the world. I'm just going to be good. And I'll be gone when the evils of the world will create this mess. And it will, they call it the tribulation. A lot of this, of the language for this, comes from the book of Revelation. Revelation 20 is very is an important piece of rapture thinking, because it talks about the end of the dragon, the end of what now in rapture thinking is conflated into the Antichrist. But Revelation was written by a man named, we consider John of Patmos, who was a prisoner of the Roman Empire, and he was writing about his time and about the persecution of his people, the Christian people, in his time and place. We know that. In 1830, almost nobody knew that. In 1830, Darby decided that it was absolutely necessary to read the words off the page in the Bible just the way they appeared in English. Just as if those words were written for early 19th century Britain. And then, as future generations have come along and the center of rapturous thinking has moved to America, rapturists continue to read their Bible as if it was written on the page for them with their culture, the way they see the world. It is in rapturous circles forbidden to understand the Bible was written by the individuals who wrote it, in the times that it was written, in the context that surrounded the writing, and for the purposes they had. Now, in that way, rapturous thinking
comes together with what we call fundamentalism. Does anybody here have an idea when fundamentalism came into the world? I know you.
It wasn't so long ago.
No. Fundamentalism appeared among Presbyterians in the early to mid 1880s. The number one foundational doctrine of fundamentalism, we call it inerrancy, was enunciated by a man named A.A. Hodge, who was a seminary professor in Princeton, in 1880. Instead of being, we think of it as conservative, in Christian terms, it's a very late development. It's a very late development. And even A.A. Hodge, who looking at Darby's doctrine, said these are unscriptural and unprofitable. Even though they agree that you try to read the Bible as if it were written for you entirely without any understanding of where it came from and what it was about. Most of the academic Bible scholarship didn't agree with either man. And one of the things that we find is that up until the 1960s, dispensationalism, you don't find it in the seminaries. But in the U.S., from 1880 to 1940, all of the Bible institutes and Bible colleges are founded by rapture believers and are specifically created to teach rapture theology.
Rapture or just this fundamentalism?
No, the rapture theology, this dispensationalism. Dispensationalism is far more complex than fundamentalism. It's extraordinarily complex. I'll get to you in a minute because I'm on a roll with one thought, and I'll get to you right away. What happens in dispensationalism is Darby has this, what to him is an insight. Incredible insight. The insight is that the process of prophecy stops for the Jews when Christ dies. Then you have this period for the church, and in order to get back to dealing with the Jews, you have to get the church out of the way. That's the end. And so the last 7 years is to give the remaining Jews a chance to get back on board. That's his insight. It is like solving a crossword puzzle by making up your first word. And then every word that goes into that puzzle has to take into account the letters that you put in your first word. And so by the time you have created the entire crossword puzzle, the whole thing isn't what whoever did the crossword puzzle wanted it yet. But you could be absolutely satisfied because it's yours. Okay? Now.
Hey, so your statement before you started was that all of the Bible colleges that have been established in the United States were actually established by rapturists?
Yes. Yes,
so Viola, I come from California. I find that
from 1880 to 1840. From 1880 to 1940.
From
1880 to 1940.
So Darcy's little sect created enough momentum.
What create? Okay, this will go to where we get momentum. There was a con man who've been in prison for bigamy. And his name was Schofield.
Schofield Bible.
Yeah. That's right. He got out of prison and he said, I don't want to go to prison anymore. What's safe? What is a safe business? Well, I'll print Bibles. Now, he was another guy with bright ideas. He was very entrepreneurial. And he did two things that nobody else had done in printing Bibles. Two things. One is he noticed that as scholarship was increasing, that more and more and more people were feeling very uncertain of how they could interpret the Bible, as it was starting to leak out that you really can't read it off the page as if it were written for you in English today. Okay? So he put commentary in the same page with the Bible, so that you would be reading what was, thousands of year old scripture, and then you would come to commentary. This is what it means. Right on the same page. Okay? Schofield didn't have any expertise, so what he did was he went back in time and dusted off Darby, which was still not much. And he said, hey, no copyright anymore. This guy's been in, Darby had come to the U.S. In the 1870s and had made tours, barnstorming, revivals, all that kind of stuff. And so there was a little reservoir of interest. He, 1909 to 1911, created the Schofield Bible. Then he used his second innovation, door-to-door Bible salesman, and went throughout the entire American South and Midwest, knocking on farmers' doors. Farmers, people who still at the now a farmer's gotta have a university degree. Yeah? At that time, it's still a farmer was not that far away from his grandparents as peasant. Tended to be the least literate part of American society at that time. They tended to be people who were breaking free of the peasant, but hadn't entered any kind of a rural middle class. They were in a limbo, and they were uncertain of themselves. So you were knocking on the door and says, here is the word of the Lord. Here is what you need. Here is the truth. And by the way, you don't have to have any worries about understanding it. It tells you right inside. Okay? That is where the legions who propelled this came from. Okay? It's still under the radar. Sociologists didn't care. People in the universities who studied religion really didn't care. Who cares what the loonies out on the fringe are doing? And every year there's another.
No, it's who are the loonies out on the fringe.
That's right.
If I'm not diverting the topic a little bit, what happened at the turn of the first millennium after Christ in Europe?
What happened then was that the stratum of society that was semi-literate at least and really had intellectual curiosity went into turmoil. And there was And there actually was, at least in some jurisdictions, actually an almost stop of work for nearly 2 years. There was starvation because there was less work going on. Because the same thing that we've seen in a more hysterical form, that they were expecting the world to end. They didn't believe in a rapture, but they did expect a world to end. The one extraordinarily good thing that happened out of that expectation of the world to end is chattel slavery of white Europeans to white Europeans ended right then, right about then. And that was the beginning of serfdom, where now our ancestors were owned by the land, and the master owned the land. That was,
And how did that play out as far as how did society develop out of that, or more from the idea it's all going to end, it's the millennium, and then get back to business?
What happened, they didn't really get back to business very well for over a century. What happened was that in southern France, there was a Christian variant, which we now call the Cathars, who ignored almost all the process that was going on in the church and actually created an early Renaissance. And so what produced a getting back to business were the Crusades, where the church mobilized fervor, first sending it to Jerusalem, then quote, accidentally sending it to Constantinople, and then finally sending it to southern France to wipe out 600,000 Catholics. But that's another story. But it was actually that use of channeling energy into war that was used. You might imagine that 1,000 years from now, somebody will be giving a lecture saying, "Well, how did they get back to normal at the end of the second millennium?" Well, they channeled into war. They created a war on terrorism and tried to get the whole community, on the same page and send them back to the Middle East to kill infidels. It's not working that well, but there's some of that.
I'd like to be able to have people's voices and hear concerns, how we see this being played out in our time and in the current administration and just the general political climate, the way it influences politics beyond necessarily the White House or whatever. And just I'd like to hear from people in the room.
I got interested in this topic because I started reading some speeches by Bill Moyers, a PBS journalist, who was warning us before the last election that 40% of Americans believed in this and they were going to vote for George Bush because they thought that he was going to propel us forward to that moment. So that's why he was saying, this is something that you need to be very aware of and very concerned of. And he has a lot of people in his administration who are also believers in this, including Tom Lehrer and some people in that neocon,
Harriet Miners.
So could you talk a little bit about that?
What's really Very, very interesting. When you look at the neocon conspiracy, is that most of the people who are at the center of it are not believers in anything. They are absolute pragmatists. They believe in owning people. Flat out. It's what they believe in. The more I can get, the more I can get the world to work the way I want, because I want it, not from principle, but because I want it. If they have any, the better. If they have any principle, the principle is, I'll, make the world aligned so that I can do what I want to it. But the entire second ring is permeated with rapturous believers. There are aides in the White House who were, and many of them, who were homeschooled so that they would be untainted with any common experience of interacting with people who don't believe like they do. And there they are in the White House.
May I interject really quickly that not all homeschoolers are neocons?
Yes.
For that reason, as a homeschool lobbyist, I am out there fighting to, against that.
And I've been homeschooling my kids for a while.
Yeah. But I am willing to keep, to make this even stronger of a point. Right now, I'm actually up in Washington State, and we're a state organization. We're fighting a group called HSLDA, Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Mm-hmm. They are evil. They started their own college on the East Coast, right next to D.C., folks, in Virginia, mm-hmm. And they have a thing called Project Joshua.
Right.
They are completely indoctrinating people in how to manipulate the political system to get their religious agenda in. I'm a person of faith. I oppose that.
What is Joshua famous for?
The Battle of Jericho.
Yeah, that's right. Knocking down the walls. Right.
I wanted to go back to something you said towards the beginning. You were talking about how a lot of rapturists, obviously don't feel like the environment needs to be paid attention to because, just go to hell literally and we'll all be swept off anyway. And just to take that further, I remember reading something that not only is it just, just let the environment be degraded, but that there's actually an agenda with a lot of rapture thinking to intensify ecological destruction, because that will speed up the coming of Christ.
All of that, Christianity is unavoidably a religion that includes a concern with end things, end times. One of the elements of that coming from Jewish eschatology was a picture of the world actually ending. And so the language that Jesus used and those who followed him the first few generations used images from there in some cases. So we have that in our DNA. Now, it's really interesting when we look at what Jesus actually taught and what he actually did and what he actually wanted. He was the translation that works best when you look at what Jesus was actually doing. He was wanting the kingdom of heaven. And I say kingdom. Rather than kingdom, because kingdom focuses you on who rules, and kingdom focuses you on who lives there. And the kingdom of heaven is us. The translation of the end of the world that we get as the end of the world is equally valid, and it makes much more sense as end of the age, because he was talking about creating an entirely different set of psychological, ecological economic and political relationships based on giving, based on loving, based on no seeking advantage. So the age of seeking advantage, the age of the empire, would end, and the age of embrace will begin when people did what he said.
Thomas?
Yes.
Wondering, having, you know, having a picture and recognizing, especially with this history that you've laid out for us and how that's been, and I know there are people here who are part of our circle who have grown up in fundamentalist mm-hmm. and extreme religious circumstances. And recognizing that our political structure is really strongly influenced right now by people who are of this mindset, what do we do with this information?
Well, one of the things,
and I'd love to hear from other people as okay. well. What do you think we do with this information?
Let me put it out, and then I really want to hear this also from you. But my right off the bat prescription is first of all, be prepared to, when you meet somebody who believes like this, to show them where they've been conned. This book, one of the first that I got on the subject, the very first, The Rapture Exposed, the very first line is, "The rapture is a racket." When you have a chance, find out. Load yourself with facts. Be able to say, you know, this isn't Christian doctrine. This was invented in England in 1830. It's very deflating for these folks who really think they have been taught that this is where it's always been. Okay, once you get your facts, this whole process can be undercut, undermined. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to understand that the kind of viciousness that gets seen in these circles is not Christianity, never was Christianity, isn't what Christianity is for. And the fact that these people scream and scream and scream, "Look at me, I'm a Christian." People who are non-Christian, people who are secular, people who are of other religions, end up looking as if that's what a Christian is. I think maybe we ought to exterminate. Okay? Get it that if they can't con you into thinking that their way is the right way, they've still conned you into thinking that they are what represents Christianity. So free yourself from the con. Okay, those are the two things. Any other ideas or any other comments?
Could you address how Iraq plays into this prophecy so that we can
understand more of the political? Okay, I will in a minute. Every time I do that, we cut off people from being able to say, this is time for, we'll speak though.
Yeah, when we would be talking to someone mm-hmm. about this, and it's been a long time since I've read Revelation, but they can certainly make a case for
what they can't. No, they can't. They say they can, and they prove it to each other,
right.
And they quote it in the movie, and they quote it in the book. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that what they've done is they've taken Revelation, they've taken the whole Bible, mm-hmm. but the Revelation in particular, and turned it into confetti, and then they pick up a little. And they say, see, this is in Revelation. It's in the Bible. You know,
cut and paste.
Yeah, it is. It's a cut and paste job.
I will agree with you, and that is what they're going to come back with.
And say, Let's read it in context. Let it read it word for word in context and find out where it came from.
The sociological.
What the context is, what, you know, all that. And I want to get to Iraq, but let's, you and you.
Well, you know, I see this rapture as, and the fact that we've got 30 to 40% of the population wanting to believe this is more in an indication of a mindset that's has its justification, hangs its justification on the rapture. I think the larger issue is to help people transfer from this idea that there are rules that are we're going to have to follow. There's some sort of a fate of the society, and move into a more creative mindset, then argue directly against, okay, no, you shouldn't believe rapture because the Christian...
No, it's not a matter of shouldn't believe. You say, you show them that they're con.
Yeah, but I...
That undoes... This is an emergency. Now, have you ever taken a four-year-old? Have you got kids?
No.
Oh,
but
oh.
You see, my point is not to argue directly with this, but be more of a, it's more of a philosophical discussion and just an observation that we've got a lot of people wanting to believe this.
Yes, they do.
I don't think you go anywhere with trying to convince
it
them.
It is much harder to, it's much harder to move a state of consciousness upscale than it is to show that the house of cards you've got is a house of cards. It's just much, much harder. And what I was going to use as an example is a state of consciousness. A four-year-old wants to be told the same story again and again and again, and wants it said in the same voice, in the same words. And if you have ever tried to get a four-year-old to get it that, you know, it's not good bonding for me to be bored to death, they can't get it. That's their state of consciousness. Okay? You have to respect that people are in a state of consciousness, and to move them from one state of consciousness to another is a much bigger project. Much bigger project than to tell them they don't have to be afraid. And because that's what's not going to work. Telling them that what they focus their fear on, you know, doesn't stand up will work. If they will believe you. There was...
the thing that I heard, what I think David was saying, is that for to talk about the con, to talk about the history and all those things, even the theology, is within the domain of formal reasoning and logic, and to some extent theology, and those things. And I suspect that the belief in this thing operates in the domain of faith, and we encounter this on
I'm a person of faith.
Well, I agree.
I'm a person of faith.
The thing that the government succeedingly retreats back to is well, this is a faith based thing. This is not a reality based thing, you know. And how, you know, I'm not clear at all how you enter in that argument, you know.
It takes preparation. It takes far more preparation than most people seem to be willing to do, but it takes preparation.
I would venture to say that everyone in this room has a worldview.
Yes.
And I would venture to say that many of us would agree with most of the worldviews in the room. But, for example, that we wanted to get David to change his worldview, how would we go about doing that?
Depends entirely on how he structures his worldview. Rapture's worldview is logical process. It is puzzle solving. It is like putting together an automobile. It's a theoretical automobile. And the fact is that the darn thing won't drive. It is the premises of faith are very few. That's one of the peculiarities of rapture thinking. It is built on... Here, let me give you an example. There is a thing in the book of Daniel that says at least, you know, 70 weeks, probably is going to last 70 weeks from the time some foreign overlord gives Jews the right to come back. Well, there actually was a time when Artaxerxes allowed a small band of Jews to come back. So, since the word for weeks is the same word as for sevens, Darby decided that he was really talking about 70 years. So it's 70 sets of 70 years from the time of Artaxerxes' decree till the end of this period where Jesus is killed. It doesn't work out. Okay? So what do they do? Well,
make it fit.
They make it fit. The final way, they make it fit fully three or four different ways, but the final way they make it fit is they decree that a prophetic year is 360 years, 60 days instead of 365. So sort of taking something from astrology, perhaps, huh? But
not that either. Actually, politically, I think the best thing you can do is let your representation know that you don't fall into that camp. Again, I lobby at the state level in Washington for no money, by the way. It's out of pocket. yeah, and they listen. They do. We go in. I'm a mom. I take my kids. My kids have lobbied with me. We go in, and I'm actively lobbying against this very group of people who want to structure laws that are going to influence how I live my life. I honestly don't care how they believe. I choose to believe my way. I don't agree with them. I don't think it's very rational, but there's people who don't think my being an astrologer is very rational either. So, but I would like it to be legal. So I don't want to change that. I just want to keep my freedoms available. How I've gotten some very conservative people to not vote pro-conservative neocon type bills was by, first of all, giving them the bottom line. This is going to cost you money. They always hear money. This is going to cost you votes. The Northwest especially, if you look at the U.S. Census report on education, the Northwest and the Northeast are blue states for a reason. We have more people of higher education. The further into the South, which was broken politically at one point in our history, its education is also broken. I think it reflects. I just seriously did the research the other night because I thought, is there a smart people index or something? Yeah, there is. There really is. But go. You have the right. They will listen to you. They have to. They can't stop you from going to their office. So from a political point of view, if you don't believe like them, don't be afraid to say no. If you're not a Christian, don't be afraid to say you're not one. If you are, I'm not with them, thanks. Unless you are, and then that's fine to be with them. But if you're not, say it.
But let me answer the Iraq question. We're not going to get to it. Okay. We have at least two more who want to contribute. What happens in Iraq is the internal neocon desire to create a democracy in Iraq, which they masked in all of the lies that we're so familiar with, comes out of two reasons. One is they just flat wanted the oil, and they wanted to be able to jury-rig elections so that they would get people in there who would let them get the oil and send it here to the U.S. The other thing they wanted was to appease their rapturist fringe. And the project of completely destabilizing and restructuring what was going on among Arabs who had a history of being very anti-Israel was to encourage those same elements in Israel who have been moving Israel inexorably towards the right. And to say, see, we really are your friends. We got rid of one of your worst enemies. That's how those two pieces work. So, you had one?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she.
Forgive me if I missed some since I came in late, but are you familiar with the website skepticsannotatedbible.com?
I actually saw it once, but no, I'm not familiar.
I use it in discussions with my mom, who won't let go of the idea that I might someday become a churchgoer again, though I haven't really been since I left home. It itemizes all the passages in the Bible by category that would apply to certain categories: violence against women. Contradictory. And so there's a section contradictions that everything in it is a pair or more of passages in the Bible that contradict each other. And it's excellent. It's an excellent place to refer people that fully believe that they can, base their life on the Bible. Because you can discredit that idea that the Bible is written by God and infallible. You can just discredit it about 1,000 ways by looking at this website.
You're discredited by reading it yourself.
Well, yeah. It's a handy reference.
Anyway, yes.
You mentioned earlier about talking to people in the context of, like, you don't have to be afraid, rapture believers. But I'm a little bit confused, because it seems to me if I was a fundamentalist who believed in the rapture, I wouldn't be afraid at all, because I would know how to live my life such that I wouldn't be one of the ones swept away. What I've noticed just reading sort of boards online and things like that is that the dominant sort of attitude that I pick up on coming from rapture thinkers is this smugness. There's like this superior smugness that I'm going to be saved and the rest of you, seculars, Muslims, Jews, people, liberals, all of you guys, you're going to be left behind and just you wait. It'll be
and
so delicious.
You right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It serves you right. That's
kind of feeling.
That's sublimated viciousness
so I don't pick up on
and anger.
Fear at all.
Yeah, that's where it comes from. No. The root is fear. The root is, now I don't have to be afraid, and you do. That's where the transferring fear is.
I was just going to say that. I think people who need that assurance to say, I'm right and you're wrong, and my pastor told me and I know the truth now, they really are afraid. They're very insecure, and they're just looking for something. I mean, it seems to me that the people who get recruited for some of these types of, like in college, in colleges, people who are away from home, who don't have any friends, who are very insecure, who don't know what to do, they get recruited into these campus crusades and all these other things that...
What if you were born into it and you were brought up with it, though, and you were homeschooled and all that? I mean, I don't necessarily think that those people are really afraid. That's just what they believe.
Many of those in that category are the most likely to drift away.
Can I also, I want to say something also before.
Tell everybody what your background is.
Yeah. I'm a retired religious studies professor on the East Coast. I taught in a Catholic school. But at the time I was teaching there, we were very open to all kinds of students. We even had Muslim students. We had some Jewish students. Mostly Christian, but not all Catholic. I think that I was doing this this work in the classroom, the scholarship, and I was pointing out all the errors of rapturist thinking and fundamentalist thinking and say, hey, this is what the scholarship is. This is where this stuff came from. I mean, I can take the book of Revelation apart and show all the, this is Nero and this is this and this is this, and many of the students would get that. But they have to be somewhat open-minded. People who are really insecure, who are really afraid, who come from an evangelical background or a literal Bible reading background, they would just close their minds. They wouldn't hear me. And they're so afraid. And something you said before to us when we were at table, that we can't always just go and attack them. If we go and attack them, they're going to dig themselves in.
Right. But we can give them the opportunity to examine their own their, you know, their own data.
Yeah, but what I hear her saying is that it doesn't really change the people. In fact, I don't
think
it
can. It can change people if they have any amount of open-mindedness. I have been for 15 weeks. And that's how much time you need.
Right, but isn't the majority of our population that believes rapture?
I'm sorry.
Isn't the majority of the population that believes in rapture not open-minded?
No, and they're not coming to my school.
Wait a minute. There's a fallacy here, and one is, what about the people who just read those 60 million books, and that's all they've gotten?
I don't. In fact, I'm sorry. Can I change the subject just a little? Tomorrow night, the last night of a political play at the Firehouse Theater on Interstate. It's called Dirty Story, and it's about, the four characters in the play are Israel, the Muslim, and the U.S. and England. And you kind of don't find that out till kind of the end of the first act, but it's a very good play. And it doesn't really take sides on it, but kind of tells what the situation is. Like the U.S. is the cowboy, and he's handing out guns all over the place and so forth. It's a political play. And I wanted to mention that.
Okay. So anybody else with comments?
I just have one comment. I brought a couple of copies of the Left Behind, the kids' novels. And I put it underneath the television.
Oh, yes, I see it.
There's 39 volumes. And there's also graphic novels. So I thought you might like to see that if you happen to
see what is pervading, what is entering your body politic behind your back.
A lot of Christian rock
for
teenagers, too.
The agenda is purely political.
No, the agenda is psychological for these people, but it has this enormous political impact.
This may be a little bit plain spoken, but I'm really not thinking about going out and trying to change any of their minds. I'm thinking about going out of this room and figuring out what I need to know to keep them from doing more harm in my country.
Well, then you follow what Lori said.
Yeah, lobby. Get down there.
But I tend to agree with that. You know, I have a lot of friends who are about this persuasion. We all have our own belief systems, but for me to expect to change who they are, is that my responsibility? But is it my responsibility to be aware of the influence they have on our federal government and make my needs?
Your responsibility is always to your own mind, but you have the responsibility to every mind around you to tell them the truth, whatever you think the truth is. Just as they have the responsibility to tell you what they think the truth is, and they're not shy about it. And the fact that you get shy and they aren't is part of the problem.
Are the raptures only in the United States?
It's almost exclusively the U.S. and England. The other English-speaking countries, somewhat,
they're in Mongolia now.
The base population.
Over here.
Yes.
Is Bush himself and his cronies, are they rapturous or are they using it as a power?
Bush personally declares himself the rapturous. Most of the neocon junta that pulls his strings are not, but a lot of his aides, a lot of the lawyers that he hires, a lot of the people who are the face of his administration are.
Is it true that Armageddon takes place between the Tigris and the Euphrates River?
No. Tell them where Armageddon is. It's a little tiny.
No, it's in Israel.
Yeah, it's a little tiny plane about 5 miles wide in northern Israel, close to the end, and that's where we get the name Armageddon. Tank battles during World War II, were hundreds of miles wide, right? And we're looking at the end of the world battle pictured in the rapture stuff as if it were tank battles on a postage stamp. You know, it's just weird.
A lot of people think that religion is dangerous. Mm-hmm. We were telling you at supper there was this guy named Sam Harris who wrote a book that religions are terrible, they're awful, they ought to be, the end of them ought to come. But I'll tell you something. There's too many people, especially in the United States, who are still calling themselves religious, who want to be believers. And, you know, that's not the way I want to go myself personally. The way I want to go is the way that this evangelical Jim Wallace is going. Jim Wallace is an evangelical. He's the one who started the Sojourners community years ago. And he has written a book called God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. And his thesis is that we all need to educate ourselves to find out the truth about Armageddon, where it is, Megiddo in Israel, to find out the truth of the Book of Revelation, you know, to get yourself somewhat knowledgeable, but then, more importantly, to use the religious language to take back moral values that are important to us, like social justice, peace, stop oppressing the poor, stop running under our feet, like Amos says. You know, that kind of language, we should take it back and not let the right wing take our language into the political
sphere. That's why I and my wife started a church. Flat out, we are a church. We're Christ the Healer. You know, United Church of Christ Church. Very, very controversial in the circles we run in. Okay? Because we are taking those things back.
Yeah. It's 9 o'clock, so we need to start bringing our discussion to a close. And one thing I would point out, Living Earth isn't a church. But Living Earth does operate on strong spiritual principles. And my sense is that any religion and every religion, in its essence and at its core, points toward spiritual values, points toward how you connect your own essence with your place in the universe and connect your own essence with the molecular level of your body. Of our organic existence. And that is, you know, there are different paths that may be Christianity, that may be Islam, that may be Native American or Wicca, or a lot of different paths. And that essence of spirituality is found in every religion and also is absent in every religion. And it is found in Living Earth, but Living Earth isn't a religion. So,
well, and when you're using those words, you're talking labels, and it is found and not found under every label.
Right, right.
But yeah, there's some differences. Anybody is at all interested in finding out a little more about our expression and our effort to express what Christianity is, Gabriel has a few of our newsletters for this month, and just take a look.
And Thomas, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That last was the voice of Betsy Toll. We're at the Multnomah Friends Monthly Meeting House at 4317 Stark. It's about 9 o'clock on Friday, October the 7th. This is Glen Owen, Cable News.